Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 14th, 2016. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, first up, the Harney County, Oregon occupation of a federal building out in the boonies of a so-called wildlife refuge. Now, I'm rather relieved to report that as of Tuesday morning, January the 12th, there is nothing to report, which is good, because any developments down there are almost certain to be negative ones. This is one of those no-news-is-good-news situations. Earlier in the week, we published one email on the Thought Crime blog, which I received from a comrade who did a supply run down there, and as of the weekend, the men and apparently a few women as well were holding up, and the dictator's servants were merely lurking in the background, hiding in their big RVs with the antennae and the satellite dishes sticking out, kind of like big metal cockroaches, Franz Kafka meets Star Wars kind of thing. Now let's hope it stays that way, but I think we all know it won't. The main thrust of the dictatorship's efforts seems to be directed at finding some way to get the militiamen to disperse on their own so that they can be raided and arrested separately, dragged from their beds in the dawn by the men in the black body armor. Now, so far, Ammon Bundy and his people aren't falling for it. Now, that's about all I can tell you now. This situation can change at any minute. The so-called Siege of Wounded Knee in 1973 lasted 71 days. I kind of doubt this will be allowed to go on for that long, but we'll see. Anyway, for now, let's do some emails. Got this one from one of our British listeners named Chris. Dear HAC, in the NF's communities, by which I mean those close proximity clusters of NF activists, does legal paramilitary weapons and guerrilla warfare tactical training ever physically take place? I don't see what the point is in having outnumbered clusters of like-minded people all living in the same region with a view to secession and or independence without any kind of realistic view to eventual organized violence whatsoever. In my experience here in my own country, meetings of well-meaning folk at periodic gatherings serve no more purpose than to simply appeal to some very few holdout pockets of independent-minded people within the white population who have internet access scattered throughout the land. There is never any clearly defined point to such meetings, and gatherings and what little political activity that does take place never amounts to anything more than futile gestures, such as once again attempting to reach out to the ideologically conditioned masses and cause the system to enhance a few pre-existing contradictions within its so-called free and democratic system of perverted law and government. Does the Northwest Front or do Northwest activists actively engage in legal paramilitary training exercises? And if it doesn't, is the reason for this simply because its activists are just too chicken shit to push the envelope in the way that they purport to be pushing it in their many novels, blogs, and political dissertations? If so, then what is the actual point, if any, of forming unmilitarizable, all-white, race-based communities in the Pacific Northwest? Signed, Chris. Okay, Chris, let me run this down for you and also for a lot of our American comrades who, unlike me, were not around during the 1980s and 1990s and therefore do not remember what happened back then. At one point in the early 80s, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, or ADL, had a very bad paramilitary training scare thanks to a turkey named Fraser Glenn Miller, who has gone down in history as the mighty white supremacist who was so stinking drunk that he opened fire in the parking lots of both a synagogue and a Jewish community center and didn't manage to hit a single Jew. But before that little contretemps that landed Brother Miller on death row at the age of 73, Glenn had a long and illustrious previous career of fucking up the white nationalist movement under his belt. I will not go into that history in detail because I long ago made the decision that that sort of thing was not what Radio Free Northwest would ever be used for. But in this one case, Miller's past monkey shines do in fact have some lasting relevance to our present day situation, so I'm going to suspend my no goo-boo rule just this once, so listen up. In the early 80s, Bob Matthews and his boys from the Order knocked over an armored car in Ukiah, California, and spread the money around among a number of movement grouplets at the time, one of them being Glenn Miller's White Patriot Party in North Carolina. And I forget how much money Matthews gave Miller. I think it was $200,000. That's 1983 dollars now. In addition to vast quantities of beer and whiskey, Miller used that money to purchase about 1,000 Confederate flags, a whole bunch of Army surplus camouflage fatigue outfits for his members, huge stockpiles of guns and ammo, and also pay a coterie of his drinking buddies full-time salaries as so-called organizers. Now, to be fair, love him or hate him, in his day, Miller was dynamic. Like many functioning alcoholics, until the very end, when the whiskey started to destroy his brain cells and corrode his mind, Miller could actually function tolerably well, so long as he had a load on. And from 1983 to early 1986, I have to concede, he got some impressive results. And he gave us an example of what can be done by one of our groups during the brief window of time when we have access to adequate funding. I believe you can still find some old videos of Glenn's marches and whatnot on YouTube. Do a search on White Patriot Party. The other impressive example of this sudden once-in-a-lifetime influx of serious working capital into the movement was the late Dr. William Pierce, who used the $300,000 he got from Bob Matthews and the Order to buy land, the West Virginia compound, which is still around and in play. Well, sort of. And not for much longer, but that's a whole other story I won't get into. Anyway, one of the things that Miller did with his new circle of many drinking buddies, all attired in uniform camos and all armed with brand spanking new AR-180s and Ruger Mini-14s, with mountains of ammo to burn, was to build a proper firing range out on his farm in Johnston County, North Carolina, for his boys to shoot at proper targets instead of just blasting away at their own empty beer cans and whiskey bottles. Miller then proceeded to conform with and reinforce virtually every liberal and Jewish stereotype about us, almost like he was following a Hollywood script. He invited the media onto the property so that he could show off all his dozens of new drinking buddies with their snappy new uniforms, blasting away at paper nigger targets with their new semi-autos while guys in sergeant stripes barked orders and the Confederate flag billowed in the breeze overhead. All very inspiring, I'm told. And needless to say, this story with video and photos was all over the three major networks at the time and the fledgling cable networks and the newspapers, which people still read back then. And it scared the Jews shitless, not to mention the political and economic establishment elites in North Carolina. Now, the ADL and the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, leaped all over it, and to make a long story short, the result was the ADL's draft paramilitary training statute, which was lobbied by the Jews out the wazoo in the 1980s and passed by a number of individual states, including a number of them in the Northwest, most likely. I don't know. I haven't bothered to look it up because we don't do anything remotely resembling that, so it doesn't concern us at this time. The Jews used state legislatures to avoid any problems from Congress from the NRA lobby, since the terms of these laws were so broad that they were clearly prohibited by the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. But once again, to make a long story short, these paramilitary training laws do exist, and they are on the books in most states, thanks to Glenn Miller's wanting to cut a drunken swagger in front of some 1980s info babes. So far as I know, no one has ever actually been prosecuted under these laws because they weren't designed to prevent paramilitary training. They were intended to give the FBI an excuse to arrest and imprison Glenn Miller for being Glenn Miller and rocking the boat, just like North Carolina electoral law was changed in order to prevent the White Patriot Party from getting on the ballot. Now, it turned out that none of these laws proved necessary in order to destroy Glenn Miller. He imploded all on his own in 1987 when the booze finally destroyed his brain to the point where he became insane. And all that money and all those men and all those camo fatigues and guns and ammo and Confederate flags are gone now. One more promising start destroyed. Pissed up against a wall in beer and whiskey urine because of our refusal to demand that our leaders demonstrate strength of character, personal integrity, honesty, sexual restraint, and moral fiber. Character gets us every time. $200,000 right down the crapper. Due to the apparently pathological inability or unwillingness of the white race to get our act together. Apparently, we simply can't be bothered. Now, Miller aside, these paramilitary training laws were also more generally intended to give the authorities another tool in their legal arsenal to do an end run around the First Amendment and to arrest political dissidents and put them in prison, despite the fact that the Constitution tells the government it can't do that. Rush Limbaugh has a point. Liberals and Jews are constantly raging over living in a legal system where the fundamental law of the state spells out what they cannot do, what they are not allowed to do, which is the reason why liberals and Jews have been trying for so long to destroy the Constitution, because like all spoiled and entitled children, they cannot abide being told what they cannot do. Now, this doesn't mean that various groups of good old boys since then haven't gone out in the woods, drunk a lot of beer, and then plinked away at the empty beer cans, or that various groups of people haven't played paintball with one another, stuff like that. I'm sure they have. It just means that these ADL-inspired Glenn Miller laws are so dodgy, so constitutionally nebulous as far as freedom of speech and freedom of assembly in the Second Amendment goes, that just about anything could be considered paramilitary training by some FBI agent or U.S. attorney, including a Boy Scout jamboree, or an outdoor revival meeting, or a corporate retreat in a forest preserve where the executives play paintball with each other. But by the same token, these laws are so shaky that some federal judge who doesn't like the U.S. attorney pressing the case because he cheats at golf, or who doesn't like the female U.S. attorney arguing the case because she won't meet him in a luxury hotel room and perform assorted perversions on his withered old body, that judge might decide to get into a pissy mood and throw the whole model statute out as grossly unconstitutional, which of course it is, and maybe invalidate years of work and millions of dollars of expenditure on the part of the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, who claim the passing of these stupid things is one of their greatest achievements from times gone by. Okay, Chris from London. Dragging myself, kicking and screaming, finally back to your question. No, the Northwest Front does not conduct formal paramilitary training exercises of any kind for a variety of reasons having to do with the fact that up here we at least try to live in the real world. Sometimes without much success, but at least we try. All these other groups don't. I know that there are some groups who do engage in various kinds of paramilitary training. Presumably, Ammon Bundy and his people did some shooting and whatnot on his ranch back in Nevada. And so far, the FBI has not attempted to arrest them under these ADL Glenn Miller laws, at least not that I've heard. But when some special agent in charge decides that he or she needs to spiff up their resume with the suits back in the J. Edgar building, they usually go to the trouble of inserting one or more of their $400 per week men into the group and recording some drunken beer talk in the cow barn and talking some of these people into quote-unquote holding a few things for me, i.e. common household chemicals, which in the indictment are magically transformed into bomb-making materials, that kind of thing. In other words, the classic FBI frame. My personal belief is that it is still possible to prepare for all eventualities and not trip over Glenn Miller's festering legal carcass 35 years after he got a snootful and invited the media onto his property to show off his toys. I keep telling you people, 95% of the things you need to do to prepare can be done without breaking any of the dictatorship's laws. So long as there is no combination of guns or uniforms or actual ranks, like some guy calling himself Generalissimo with captains and colonels and whatnot, I don't think the dictatorship will try using Glenn Miller law. They'll take a run at you in some more traditional way, like planting evidence in your truck, drugs, or hand grenades or something. An FBI agent once told me that they could get rid of me anytime they want, just get an anonymous tip that I had hand grenades under my bed, and then they'd break into my apartment and find them when I wasn't there. And things haven't changed much, I don't think. Except now, under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, they can also just shoot me through the head if they don't want to bother with all the formalities. Now, I do not advocate formal training sessions for the NF, not just because of these assorted Glenn Miller laws and conspiracy laws and whatnot, but because formal training isn't necessary. The skills that are necessary for future white survival, everything from the care and handling of firearms to the woodcraft and survival skills to medical and first aid skills to urban guerrilla tactics, can all be acquired on a one-to-one basis. The kind of thing fathers used to teach sons on hunting trips, back in the days when fathers took sons on hunting trips. Now, you don't need formal training sessions with everybody in camos. You don't need guys swaggering around pretending to be colonels and field marshals and blah, blah, blah. On that far-off day, when the Northwest Volunteers are finally brought into existence per the White Book, it will be just volunteers, no officers, NCOs, Sultans of Swing, or anything that the FBI can make into little mafia-like organizational charts. Knowledge does not require to be imparted to a large group while wearing a costume. It simply needs to be imparted or otherwise acquired, notably through experience. Character, character, character. This is the Dillards.
All right, boys. A 1, 2, and a 1, 2, 1, 2.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to discuss Richard Dawkins' The Extended Phenotype. In Now, the reason why I chose this book was that there was some talk on Stormfront as to whether Dawkins tends to view races as different species. There was supposedly a quote from this book pertaining to that idea. If that quote really does exist in this book, I didn't find it in this particular edition. However, it is still a very interesting book to discuss. Now, Dawkins is a liberal atheist, and his goal is to promote atheism by way of critique of the Judeo-Christian creation stories. However, this book does not go into the subject of religion. This book is a companion to The Selfish Gene, which is a book about the selection for altruism. Now, this book contains a lot of insider biological science, and while it's an older book, it is not outdated. Why do some people accuse Dawkins of being a genetic determinist? Well, Dawkins is a biologist, and as such, he must speak of genetic variation acted upon by natural selection. So, when natural selection breeds out unsuccessful variation, some see this as an end point. Dawkins argues that for this reason, some see genes as super deterministic. I would argue this tendency is more because we tend to view the environment as something that we could potentially change, whereas we tend to view genes as something that we cannot normally change. But it's important to note that no endpoint exists for variation and selection, so natural selection is never complete. Dawkins argues that both genetic and environmental effects can be hard or easy to reverse, and he does note that our world is often very artificial, so not every behavior can be termed adaptive. For example, moths maintain a fixed angle to a light source, and this may be starlight, or it might be coming out of some sort of a hole in a cave or in a tree. As a result of this behavioral feature, which typically serves them well, they are also prone to move towards a light source, and occasionally this may be, for example, a bug zapper or perhaps a windshield at night. If moths were to develop some sort of greater visual discernment, then they would be able to allay these accidents. However, it seems that the cost of doing this would be too great for the moths, and that's why we don't tend to see an improvement in this behavior. Now, Dawkins asks us to imagine an engine that must evolve from a propeller, and at every stage it must fly. Now, in this case, it's amazing that anything ever works. And indeed, when we talk about it this way, evolution sounds rather improbable. So how do we know that it happens? Well, for one thing, we can look at how various life forms are really rather patched together. For example, we can look at the larynx in a giraffe and the eyes in a flatfish. Now, it's true that organisms try to get into some sort of an evolutionary stable strategy, and they try to have some balance between a local and a global optima. But once in a while, especially when selective pressures become very pronounced, there can be periodic changes in organisms. Now, one of the important points in this book is the way that organisms manipulate other organisms and also their environment, and this is part of their extended phenotype. Now, for example, beavers have evolved to build dams. So if a group of beavers, for example, had a mutation that tended to make them build higher or lower dams, natural selection would then act upon their communities either positively or negatively. Also, sometimes animals have parasites, which may change their behavior in favor of the parasite. Now, this also happens with cuckoos, for example, and how they take over the nests of various other types of birds. Dawkins tends to look at all of evolution with a gene's eye view. He thinks of organisms as compartments within the biosphere in which genes circulate. In this case, he must be thinking about bacteria and viruses. He says, however they happen, genetic changes always have to influence the germline, of course, And so even if it's something brought about through the tinkering of immune cells or splicing genes, if you see genetic characteristics inherited in an unusual way, that's not Lamarckianism, that's still Darwinism, because there's still a pathway into the germline. Another interesting question is this question of the term fit as used in this context. And this was a term that was suggested by Wallace, who was a correspondent of Darwin. I really have to say that I prefer the term natural selection to the term fit, because when I hear the term fit, I think of someone who goes to the gym a lot. In that context, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with reproductive success. I also like the term natural selection because it reminds me that the most successful organisms are the ones that fit into their biological niche and not necessarily the biggest or the strongest. Now, in The Selfish Gene, Dawkins discusses the fact that genes seek to maximize replication. So in that book, he asks why many organisms evolve to have their genome during reproduction. And in that book, he argues that genetic exchange facilitates evolutionary changes in organisms. In this book, Dawkins goes on to ask the question, why have genes organized themselves into discrete organisms? And he leads the reader through a series of thought experiments, eventually comes to the answer that when an organism reproduces, no matter what means of reproduction it uses, when it creates new organisms, at that point, mutations that may have arisen are able to radically redesign these new organisms. At this point, evolution can act either favorably or negatively on these various new organisms. And so eventually that would lead to a net gain. Now, it's also interesting to note, of course, that in geologic time, actual organisms as we know them are rather new because for many millennia, the Earth was simply populated by bacteria. But when organisms or when genes are pressured to create selective vehicles, what happens is that various genes clump together for mutual benefit. Now, once complex organisms are established, they may be programmed to act in kin-selective and gene-favoring ways. They may have polymorphic or conditional behavioral strategies. Now, when we are looking at something from a gene's eye view, we start to think about this web of replicators. We may stop looking at vehicle selection altogether, and we may say something to the effect, well, I believe that natural selection is happening at a microgenetic level, but without some sort of microanalysis, I can no longer evaluate natural selection in nature. And we may fall into some sort of Gaia hypothesis. Now, Dawkins says that this is an illusion because we have competition as well as harmony, which is harmony itself is something of a happy illusion. Now, also too, humans have memes, which are ideas, concepts, and ideologies. These memes, they're also replicators, and they're part of the extended phenotype of human beings, and they can reproduce and they can replicate of their own accord. They also are acted upon by selective pressures. So really, for Dawkins, the thing that moves upon the primal waters is natural selection itself. Some may ask, and this is my own commentary, some may ask if Hitler was a Darwinist. To this question, Dawkins says no, not in this book, because he doesn't address it here in this book, but he addresses it on YouTube. But I would argue that if you do read Mein Kampf, Hitler does speak of struggle for genomic survival. Now, granted, Hitler does tend to filter these views probably through Herbert Spencer and I suppose also through Wallace. But then again, nearly everyone filters Darwin through the influence of Herbert Spencer and possibly Wallace. So I can't say that's anything particularly unique. Essentially, I would tend to call Hitler a Darwinist in quite a profound sense, and I would certainly call National Socialism a Darwinist creed. So I found this book to be very interesting, and it really takes complicated biological ideas and really does make them very easy to understand. Now, there are other books by Dawkins that I also think would be fascinating to read. However, I think they are a bit too negative on the subject of religion to be necessarily appropriate for this show, because this Radio Free Northwest makes no particular statements on religion one way or the other. At any rate, I found this book to be quite an enjoyable read, and if you decide to read it, I hope you will also enjoy it. So thank you very much for listening. Have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
Yeah, I got a quick little comment from the trucker. This one's so short, I'm not even going to give him his theme music this time around. He's out on the road, but it's just basically so cold, there's nothing happening out there, except a lot of accidents and stuff.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from North Dakota. It was a balmy 21 below zero this morning when I got up. Yeah. It's definitely not a good time to be making your transition across the country, either on a scouting trip or moving, unless you're used to this kind of crap, having to dodge snowstorms and icy roads and all that. Over the weekend, I was coming across Nebraska, and there was a couple of semis piled into the concrete supports for a bridge overpass at Elk River, Nebraska. Yeah, that was an ugly situation. I don't know if there was any fatalities. I'm sure there was injuries, but definitely not looking good. The bridge won. And they had the interstate shut down where you had to get off and then right back on again at the exit. And Sunday, when I got over there into Illinois, there had been a snowstorm come through that previous evening, and there was cars slid off the road all over the place. Few trucks, yeah. Definitely not good for transiting across the country. But hey, I'm a professional. I get to do this for a living. You guys really shouldn't wait for springtime, all the stuff to blow off and whatnot. Well, I hope to be able to see you out this spring or summer, making your scouting trips or your migration to the Northwest. All right, this is a trucker signing off for another little quick tidbits from the road. Have a safe one, comrades.
As most of you will know, this week David Bowie died at the age of 69, and so I think in honor of David Bowie, we will have an evil karaoke based on one of his songs.
I'm not alone, hey. from me. Keep on pushing, but don't shove me. Hips keep falling, hips keep falling. Down, down, down. You won't recognize me. Skip my name, nothing drag on back. Hips keep falling, hips keep falling. Without your crew, your pussies, you know it's moving. I just can't tell you apart. Put you on a boat with me at the start. Don't you chip out around me. Don't you chip out around me. Knuckles drag on my. Will you rob my house? As you pimp on by. Will you check my car? When you leave your nest. You sling hot grease. Hunk of shit. Just get on a boat back to Africa again. I say
I am constantly urging you folks out there to take the initiative and get creative in promoting the NF and the Northwest Imperative on the internet and printed material any way you can to get our ideas before the white public. And I'm always flattered and fascinated when some of you, especially some of our younger listeners, take me up on it and make their own propaganda material for the NF. Now, we have a new YouTuber who calls himself Ravenfeather, who is uploading a number of new videos onto YouTube in which he mixes old audio from RFN and elsewhere with all kinds of interesting music and sound effects. I have no idea on earth who he is, although I get the impression he's pretty young. Now, this is part of one of my old RFN spritzes, which he opens with some kind of rock anthem, which is either Swedish or Serbian, and I'm honestly not sure what. Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Ty stary wróg, stał nowy zbrodnią, znacą swoje prawa. Sumienny cień, przepiąż ich zdani. Kolejna na leśnych obława. W łobudzie pławił się czerwony rząd. W luksusie, kiedy naród biedzie żył. Wyborczy fałszem, budują tron.
władzy, która obcym dała ster. A wczoraj do gdzieś wykręcimy sprawa.
You Americans have lost the consent of the governed. Do you know that only 35% of the present U.S. population pays income tax? And that's the 35% you've lost, the third that counts. The people of this country, the real people, the white people who do the work and pay the taxes and keep the machinery and the technology running, don't want you anymore. I'm sure I'm not the only one you listen to as you sit in your cubicle or sit in a Starbucks in Georgetown listening to your laptop with a headset or however the hell it works. All these other people you're monitoring, the Tea Party and the militias, the birthers and the sovereign citizen people, the tax rebels and the survivalists, the skinheads, whatever's left of the Klan, the bloggers and the Council of Conservative Citizens, what are they all about, basically? What have they got in common? They're all looking for a way to get you and Barry and Rahm and Ben Bernanke and your whole way of life off their backs. The people of the North American continent, of the U.S. and Canada, the real people, the white people, not the millions of non-productive brown scum, want you and your government and your laws and your arrogance gone, out of their lives. They're not sure how yet, and maybe the Northwest Front won't be the ones they turn to if we can't get our act together. That's on us. But listen very hard to me, all of you morally denatured droids with guns and badges and the expensive suits who hear my voice. As sick and destitute, as isolated and alone as I am, I speak for the real people of America. You no longer do. I speak for history. You speak for nobody except that pathetic primate in the White House and his little Jewish handlers. And I am telling you, we don't want you anymore. We want you gone. And when millions of white people want something bad enough, history usually finds a way to give it to us. Now, the third reason that you're going to lose is simple. We are right, and you are wrong. Okay, granted, with that and a dollar, I can buy a cup of coffee. But it sure as hell doesn't hurt. You're making a fundamental mistake that tyrants always make. You think that you can destroy an idea by destroying the people who believe in it. You think that if you can just imprison or eventually kill enough of us, the ideas of freedom and racial pride in our white heritage will disappear. But human beings and human events don't work like that. You can't infiltrate an idea. You can't put it in prison with informers and wiretaps and perjured testimony and fabricated evidence. You can't shoot an idea. That's been tried so often in the past 200 years that I'm sure even historical illiterates like you can probably recall some examples of that failure if you put your minds to it. I'm not saying that our idea is stronger than yours. I'm saying that we have one and you don't. As stumbling and confused and hesitant as we are, at least so far, we do what we do for reasons of the heart and the mind and the soul. You do what you do for money. Sure, money can beat us for a time. It has so far, and it'll beat us for a while yet, but not forever. You may wonder why I play this music I play on here. It's not just to provide my listeners with some relief from my hoarse, babbling voice. It is to show my own people what we have that makes us better than you. That music is us, not you. And because we are capable of creating it and understanding and feeling it in ourselves, we are going to win and you are going to lose. Now I want to talk to the second group of people who will someday decide the fate of our new Northwest Nation, a much smaller group of people, the white men and women who are with us now and who will be with us when the time comes. Now you ask me how you can change, how you can become the kind of men and women who will one day beat these bastards who are listening in and watching us down into the dust and rip their hearts out. As long as I am allowed to do so, I will be presenting you with all kinds of ways I think this can be done over and over and over again, but here's tonight's offering on the subject. There are two things holding you back, fear and ego. You must banish both from your mind, your heart, and your soul, because if you try to carry them into battle, you won't make it, and you will bring others down with you. You must listen to the voice that speaks inside the mind, the voice that tells you what you must do, the voice that you have been conditioned all your life to suppress and to ignore. The fact is that there is no one single guaranteed way for you to cleanse yourself of fear and of ego and the narcissism of America. It's different with every individual, but it does require a strong and disciplined act of will. When you're trying to quit smoking or drinking or some other bad bodily habit, it's a case of mind over matter. This is a case of mind over mind, and that's a lot harder. Some people simply can't do it. I get that. But we don't need for everybody to do it. We only need about 1,000 men and women out of all the millions of white people still on this continent to accomplish this mental and spiritual transfiguration. Once we get that core group here in the homeland and get them organized as the first true Northwest Volunteers, it will become comparatively easy to pick up the next few thousand we'll need, and with that small force of absolutely dedicated people, we can beat whatever Zion throws at us. How will you know when you do accomplish it? You'll know. White people live in fear all the time, and fear is a form of pain. If you're in pain all the time, you may reach the point where you don't even know it anymore. But once the pain is gone, then you damn sure know it. Ego and narcissism are harder to control because, unlike fear, they're natural components of the human mind and personality, and very few people can ever suppress them completely. But you don't have to suppress them completely, just enough for you to be able to act as part of a team to get this most important of all the jobs in history done. Fear and doubt, ego and pride, these are what stand in our way. They are strong, but they're not invincible. And just as a lion tamer can subdue and control the big cats, you can subdue and control the part of you that prevents our people from resisting. All I can suggest is that from this moment on, you make a conscious decision. No, I will not live in fear any longer. No, it's not all about me. You have that strength within you. It's your inheritance from the thousands of generations of our people who have gone before. The Jews have robbed you of much that is rightfully yours, but they have not robbed you of that inner strength. It is there within you if you will finally make the decision to use it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front Post Office Box. Okay, he faded out there with our usual closing theme, which you've already heard before. Here's another one of Raven Feather's pieces with another musical accompaniment that he added on himself. I must admit, his taste in music is pretty good, almost as good as mine. Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, like I've pointed out before, one of the things the Northwest Constitution does is to try and prevent many of the problems and abuses which have crept into the American system over the past 230 years. Among other things, the Northwest Constitution prohibits income tax and property tax on homesteads, i.e., actual homes where white families are living and white children are being raised. The Northwest Constitution does not prohibit all taxation. Tell you what, I mentioned once before that if I ever write a Fifth Northwest novel, it will be a kind of running chronicle of the first 50 years or so of the new nation's existence, as I envision it, based on the kind of events that I can foresee actually occurring. Let me discuss some of the fictional treatments I would have applied to this problem in this as-yet-unwritten fifth novel. Now, this gets perilously close to my claiming possession of a crystal ball, and that's something I try to avoid. Nonetheless, I'll respond to these questions as best I can. Just please bear in mind that these answers are not set in stone because we do not have a crystal ball, and we can't yet know exactly how everything is going to play out in real life. Now, bear in mind that I have lived in a society which in some respects approximates what life would be in the new Northwest Republic, and that is Rhodesia, where we had to live with international economic sanctions. That's the first thing we have to assume, that once the Northwest gains independence, what is left of the United States and Canada, and maybe Aslan on the southern border, will attempt to strangle the new country at birth through the imposition of an economic blockade and isolation. I'm not worried too much about that. The Republic will have to respond by building as nearly as possible a self-contained economy, manufacturing or growing or otherwise producing everything that we need. Contrary to current dogma, I believe that can be done. You have to bear in mind that a huge amount of the so-called globalized economy in Western capitalist nations is devoted to the manufacture, production, and consumption of rubbish, all kinds of things that people don't actually need. So that's one advantage we'll have in that we in the Northwest will be forced to concentrate on what we really do, in fact, need and consume. We will have a long enough border and enough of a coastline so that we can become the world's greatest smugglers. Sanctions didn't destroy Rhodesia. Internal corruption of the country's leadership did. Sanctions haven't destroyed Iran, and indeed I can't think of any case in the world where sanctions have changed governments or destroyed a nation. If anything, they get the people of a targeted country really pissed off, and they increase support for the government. Sanctions are nowhere near as hard to beat as you might think, so long as you don't have people who are demanding an endless flow of luxury goods and consumer trash. That is one reason why the Northwest Republic has to be large enough to be economically self-supporting so that we can produce all our own needs as far as basics go, food and shelter and energy. So our economy in the first few years will be a very basic and almost primitive economy. A lot of trades and professions which thrive in the United States now will cease even to exist. For example, under the Constitution, there will be no lawyers and no professional clergy, which right there gets rid of two troublesome and parasitic classes. There also probably won't be too much call in the Republic for dog groomers, tanning salons, aromatherapy candle shops, interior decorators, telemarketers, timeshare salesmen, and any of the 1,001 parasitic and unnecessary trades that serve the ultra-rich and trendy and keep the American system going. Everything in the Republic will be reduced to Spartan basics, not only out of necessity, but out of policy. The people themselves will be reduced to the essential classes. The farmer, the craftsman or artisan, the teacher, the soldier, the scientist, the scholar, and the independent entrepreneurs, merchant and suppliers who keep the economy alive by circulating goods and services. The businessman as such, the businessman as a factor in politics and national life, will disappear. Someone once said that the business of America was business. That will no longer be true. The business of the Northwest American Republic will be to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Business is about money. Our new homeland will be about heritage and blood. The big multinational corporations that employ thousands of people and are so wealthy and cosmopolitan that they constitute a state within a state will disappear. We will have a major timber and wood pulp industry, obviously, for one example. But it won't be run by Bowater and Cascade Paper, who will leech all the profits out of the country and into the bank accounts of Jews and executives and shareholders in New York and Houston and Tel Aviv. That'll have to be one of our primary economic rules. You can make a profit in the Northwest. Sure you can. But those profits stay in the Northwest, and they will not be slipped out of the country so some Jew executive in Long Island can tool into New York City in a Lamborghini, or some multinational executive can buy his daughter a racing stable in Kentucky for her 21st birthday or other such nonsense. Nor will Northwest profits be paid out as dividends to coupon-clipping stockholders all over the world. The resources of the Northwest Republic and any profits to be made belong to the white people who live here. Okay, I can already see this running so long that I take up the whole podcast with it, so let me try and wrench myself back onto the track here. We're talking about taxation. In Rhodesia, there was an income tax. I seem to recall it was about 10%, but I may be wrong on that. I honestly don't remember. There were also such things as excise taxes on gasoline and beer and liquor and so forth. There were also taxes on imported goods, the purpose of which was not only to raise money for the exchequer, but also to encourage people to buy Rhodesian. And since we made an acceptable substitute for just about everything that was imported, that wasn't really a problem. But a lot of the money the Rhodesian government made was through something called statutory bodies. And this is where we're probably going to get some people screaming and hollering about socialism. And yeah, this is a form of socialism, one made very necessary by the conditions that Rhodesia existed under and the conditions we will most likely have to endure in the Northwest Republic. It's kind of hard for me to explain just what these statutory bodies were, and I admit that at the time I didn't understand all the ins and outs of it myself. Frankly, I was young and I wasn't really paying all that much attention to economics. But basically, there were certain functions which in a purely capitalist society like the United States are performed by private corporations or contracted out, which in Rhodesia were carried out by what amounted to state-owned monopolies. In other words, they were owned and operated by the state, and they were required to make a small profit, or at least break even. And if they didn't, then heads rolled, because the Rhodesian government had to operate efficiently. There simply wasn't any room for Western-style corruption and incompetence. We had to do a lot with a little, and there was no margin for error. I'm talking about necessary services that in a seed-type situation such as Rhodesia was in had to function properly. Rhodesia Railways is a good example. There was also the phone company, the name of which I can't recall, and there were things like the electric company based largely up at the Kariba Dam, and the Coal Storage Commission, which handled meat packing and freezing for public consumption and export. You have to bear in mind that even while the rest of Africa was trying to kill us, we were still exporting food to them, which is ironic in view of the way Zimbabwe is now hovering on the brink of starvation and totally dependent on food imports. There was some kind of tobacco board type thingy as well, which handled the export of Rhodesian tobacco, which at that time was considered the best in the world after Virginia leaf. I might add that in Ireland in the 1980s, there were similar bodies for certain goods, services, and products, although since Ireland was under Marxism light instead of war socialism like Rhodesia, they didn't work that well. The old board in the telecom especially was horribly inefficient. The telephones never worked half the time. The ESB, the electricity supply board, was a little bit better. At least they kept the power on. I might add that Ireland went capitalist during the 1990s and is now largely privatized, and supposedly the phones work. Whether that's enough of a fair exchange for a country full of niggers and Muslims is something else. So that's one way that the Northwest Republic could raise money in lieu of direct taxation, i.e. establishing certain goods and services as government monopolies and charging a reasonable profit for them. Liquor, for example, to be sold only in government ABC stores. And many of us grew up with a system like that run on the state level, especially in the South. Then, of course, we'll have a lot of citizens of the Republic bitching and moaning to their deputies in the National Convention that the cost of bourbon is too high and the rates for internet service or the train fares are too high, just like people bitch and moan about paying taxes today. Look, nobody likes to pay taxes. That's just a given. And true, if we make booze a state monopoly, we'll probably have moonshiners. And to that, I say fine. If someone wants to do something better than the government, more power to them. Private competition will motivate state statutory bodies to stay competitive and not get too lazy and apathetic. As far as direct taxation goes, the Northwest Constitution will forbid income tax and property tax on family homesteads. But that still leaves a lot of possibilities open. I, for one, would not object to a reasonable poll tax, a simple annual assessment of, say, $100 a head per adult and $20 per child per household, something like that. I'm just pulling amounts out of the air here. Well, this assumes that our Northwest monetary unit will be dollars, but that's another thing I won't get into. Yes, that would mean that the better off would be able to pay a poll tax a lot more easily than someone who was poor, and the temptation would be to increase the poll tax to a higher rate for those with higher incomes, but then that wouldn't be constitutional since it would, in effect, be an income tax. This is why any poll tax would have to be very reasonable indeed, so that it wouldn't create resentment and wouldn't cause anybody genuine hardship. Now bear in mind that since the Northwest Republic would not be encumbered with a huge civil service full of bureaucrats and all kinds of entitlements, the income raised by our taxes would go a lot farther, and we would have to raise a lot less money per percentage of our gross domestic product than the old United States. Then there would be other creative ways that the Republic could raise money. For example, churches and organized religions will no longer be tax-exempt. If people want to have their nice, big, shiny churches, they can do so, of course, so long as they don't pay the priest or the preacher anything and he has to put in a full work week like everybody else. But they will also pay property taxes on their churches, unlike today. Ah, yes, the dream of many a medieval king and emperor to finally make those fat bishops and abbots pay taxes. And yes, I confess that has to do not so much with revenue enhancement as with the long-range social and political goal of removing organized religion from the political mix completely. Make the preachers earn a living and tax their property, and we'll see if these people still have the time to get into trouble and gabble about the Jews being God's chosen people. In the Republic, religion will be a matter of private belief and conscience. Organized religion will have no role in governing the state and will exist only on a very restricted level. The lack of full-time paid clergy and the taxing of their property, which will be enforced, will make sure of that. And I didn't mean to get off onto that topic, so let's get back to taxation. Another source of immediate profit will be the abandoned property of Unionists who flee from the Northwest when the Republic comes into being, either because they actively supported the American tyranny and they don't dare stick around, or else because they're just plain terrified that we're going to start slaughtering people indiscriminately, or we're going to set up some kind of bizarre dictatorship that tells everybody what color socks to put on in the morning, and so forth and so on. Now, hopefully, many of these people will come back eventually as the Republic is established and they see that we're not a bunch of monsters and we don't eat babies for breakfast. But for the first few years of the Republic's existence, there will be a lot of abandoned housing and property and things of value all over the Northwest, and the state will have to establish some procedure and some kind of authority to take this property in trust and preserve it, either for the eventual return of the rightful owners or for the use of the state if it turns out the original owners were genuine enemies of the nation and they're not coming back. What this will mean in practice is that the government of the Northwest Republic will become the largest landlord in the country, and we will be able to think up all kinds of creative ways to convert all that confiscated enemy property into revenue for the state. Basically, that's what Israel did to the Palestinians after 1948. They simply confiscated the houses and the farms and the livestock and the olive groves of the Palestinians who fled from the Jew murderers of the Haganah and the Irgun, and they sold it all at knockdown prices to incoming Jewish settlers. There will be those who claim that it won't be morally right for the Republic to steal from our own people, but let's think about this for a minute. First off, a lot of that abandoned property will belong to people who no way they're coming back to claim it. Jews, niggers, Mexicans, faggots, so forth and so on. Now, that's fair game. I am entirely comfortable with making that kind of garbage people pay for the cost of evicting them from our land. A lot of the abandoned white property will also belong to people who are genuine ideological and personal enemies and who most likely stole it in some manner or other from the white working people of the Northwest, or otherwise they acquired their property through some criminally, morally reprehensible act, in which case we have as much right to deprive them of it as the U.S. government has the right to take someone's property through asset forfeiture because they have a few marijuana plants in their backyard. Bear in mind, we won't be doing anything that the United States hasn't already done, although granted, that's not the best moral authority in the world. Look, I could go on and on like this all day, but let me wind up by reminding you that we're talking about a country with an all-white population and more or less full employment. You will be amazed what is possible for a society where everybody is the same race, everybody works, and where there are no non-whites dragging things down in the 100 different ways that they drag things down. Our new country will be a healthy place in every sense of the term, and among other things, I genuinely believe that we will have no problem providing for things like medical care for our own people, and especially for the hordes of new white children I envision. Interestingly, Raven Feather pulled that piece from before I wrote the novel Freedom Sons, which was that 50-year onward look at the Northwest Republic I mentioned. Be interesting to compare what I said there back in 2010 with the way the novel actually turned out. Anyway, for now our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.